I would speak about this topic mainly about the test field method which has been used for the determination of the coefficients in the electromotive force. I'm speaking about work which was done by these people. Mean field electrodynamics. Split B and U in this way, mean fluctuating parts, then the mean field obeys this mean field induction equation, which contains the mean electromotive force, which is a cross product of fluctuations of U and fluctuations of B. If you suppose that U is given either directly or indirectly by writing down the Stokes equations and so on, then you need the small e for the calculation of the electromotive force. The equation for the small e, which can be derived from the induction equation and the mean field induction equation, is given here. G, capital G, is the known linear term. You see from this equation that B is a functional of U, U bar, and B bar, and it is linear in B bar. If U and U bar are given, then it's linear in B bar. So you can conclude that the electromotive force has a part which doesn't depend on the magnetic field, and a part which is linear and homogeneous in the magnetic, mean magnetic field.
I'm half asleep this morning. How can E not be dependent on B?
Sorry?
How can E not be dependent on B?
On mean B, I think you might say.
Yeah, on the mean B.
Consider the definition of that there will always be linear.
A small scale line where you have no under certain circumstances you can have an E, U plus E bar.
You should not. So E naught is a sort of fluctuating good.
Yeah.
So if it was isotropic turbulence, could you have an E zero?
No. By geometric reasons, you have no isotropic vector.
Quite so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good.
It must deviate from isotropy.
Yeah.
But basically, it is.
But E0 is growing exponentially.
Sorry?
Is it growing exponentially?
E0.
It depends on small b, whether it grows exponential or not.
Right, so if it is a small scale dynamo, that thing is growing exponentially.
Yeah.
So even in the isotropic case, even though on the ensemble of all possible realization is zero, if you just take any average, this thing is growing exponentially on you.
Yeah, but as I said, if the turbulence is isotropic,
right,
you cannot define a vector of E zero.
Right, but I mean, if you take any average, no matter how long you wait, this thing will always exceed any bound that you sit there and wait because it grows exponentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, assume for simplicity only that B, small b decays with the mean field, that means no small scale dynamo, for example. Then you have simply this relation, E depends linearly on B bar with a kernel KAJ, which depends only on U and U bar, which may depend on D bar again. But then the dependence is via this this U and U bar.
Well, then it's not linear. Then
sorry?
Then you're allowing E to be a nonlinear function of B.
Yeah, I want to consider E as a function of U and U bar,
yeah,
and B. In that sense, it is linear to be
okay.
Okay. Okay, you have this representation, and in the case of the turbulence, this k vanishes for large xi and tau. Of course, E at a given point in space and time d- depends on the behavior of EFR in some surroundings versus one only.
But this may be a naive question, but why is the instantaneous electromotive force not given by the instantaneous magnetic fields? Are you considering
the magnetic field obeys an equation which has a time derivative, and this way the past, I'm saying, that's by equation. Okay, so if you need only be in a certain neighborhood of this point which you consider, it suggests itself to take a Taylor expansion, for example, in this form, and then you get an electromotive force in this way. The most frequently used ansatz is this, where you have no time derivative and no higher spatial derivative. It is clearly an approximation which needs to be checked for each application. Okay? Now, question of calculation of these coefficients A and B. I already gave this equation. The traditional way is to use first the second order correlation approximation, which is just defined by putting the nonlinear term equal to zero. And then, for example, Aij is given in this way. This is a Green's function for solving this equation. In the case U bar equal to zero, it is just the Green's function of the heat conduction equation. And here is the correlation tensor of the velocity field. If U is homogeneous and isotropic and there's no mean motion, then you find simply for alpha. In this case, say Aij reduces to a scalar alpha, and then you have simply this relation. U curl U, but different arguments here and here, and that's a weighted average. Okay, you can proceed to higher order correlations, but it is very tedious and it is only done in a few very special cases. And the method about I want to speak is a test field method. It was developed in the context of the PhD work of Martin Schrinner in Lindau, in Max Planck Institute in Lindau, and the person who initiated this PhD work was Ulrich Christensen, and I and Matthias Reinhardt were a bit involved in it. So idea is very simple. Assume, for example, this, so no E0 and no higher derivatives, that's why I say for example, choose suitable test fields, Pn, set of test fields, calculate the corresponding En, these are the E, which are defined by the test field, and calculate the electromotive force. And then write down this equation. You know the B's, you have calculated the E, and if you have enough equations, then you can obtain in this way the Aij and the Bijk. That is the idea of the test field method. You must have enough test fields, and they should be linearly independent, and the higher than first order derivatives should be small in order to be in agreement with the ansatz I made where I neglected the higher order spatial and the time derivatives. The test fields need not to satisfy any boundary condition. They even need not to be solenoidal. You are very free in the choice of the test fields. And the test field method works independent on whether U and U bar depend on E or not. And it is therefore also suitable for investigating quenching
phenomena.
The first criteria you had that the higher burgers be small, would this then run into difficulties in considering boundary layers or internal boundary layers of any sort, shear layers?
Of course, this could be a problem. Look, perhaps that's the next slide. Let me say, Martin Schlinner considered a mean, no, a dynamo model, a spherical dynamo model, and which was solved by direct numerical simulations, and then he defined averages over phi, means the average, and he extracted from the numerical solutions of this model equations, then the mean field coefficients, and then he constructed mean field models which should reproduce what the direct numerical simulations have delivered us. And it was also successful. Then in later papers, we applied this method to the simple case where B bar is defined by an average over X and Y, so that it depends only on Z, and possibly on T. Then all the first order special derivatives of B bar can be expressed by J. Excuse me, this dimensionally not quite correct. I use J bar as an abbreviation of B. And then you can write down this simple equation. And it is reasonable to restrict attention to I, J equal to 1 and 2. The third component, the set component, is not of much interest. J set is equal to 0. And okay. Then you can choose test fields like this, very simple test fields. And if you do this, then you can calculate immediately Aij and eta ij, so in this way. And here you must say the higher derivatives of these test fields go with k, say n, power of k, and the results apply exactly in the limit k. Okay. Papers made in between which use the test fields are listed here. The test field method has been used to calculate alpha and beta t in isotropic turbulence in the paper by Schur, Kandu, and Axel-Brandenburg. We studied in another paper the effects of shear and rotation on the mean field coefficients and investigated the shear current with dynamo. This is a paper where the scale dependence on alpha and eta t is considered, or more precisely, the electromotive force is written as an integral with kernels for alpha ij and eta ij, which depend on, say, psi or k in Fourier space, and these kernels have been investigated in a rather recent paper, just submitted the magnetic quenching of alpha and eta t has been investigated. And yeah, this is a paper which is under preparation, which is related to Alice ideas, mean field effects in the octopus. Okay, I don't want to speak about the details of this papers, of course, and I only wanted to introduce this field method. Thank you very much.
Can I ask Karl-Heinz about K? You said it in the limit K goes to 0, then the things are exact.
So do you have any idea how small k needs to be to give you accurate answers? We found that at higher end, k needs to be almost...
As long as you investigate only effects which go with B and not with the vertical degrees, that means alpha effect, gamma effect, you may put k equal to 0. And then...
Well, if you put k equal to 0, then you're just left putting in a mean field, you know, a uniform field, right?
Yeah.
But if you do your test field method with presumably k non-zero, I'm just trying to work out, because if you put in a mean field, then you can calculate alpha, but not eta.
Yeah. If you calculate eta, you have to look for the limit of small k.
Right.
And we did it in, for example, in this paper, you can see that there are representations on the dependence of the coefficients on k, and you see that what happens in the limit k equals 0.
I don't know if is Alice, are you going to say something about this, or is she not?
Okay, then
I'll shut up.
Questions, comments, please?
But are your results, are you saying your results are independent of the sort of test field that you choose?
The source of?
The sort of test field.
So, it has been tested already by Martin Schlimmer in the first paper where this test field method was used, and it was also tested in other cases. Different test fields were used with the same results for the mean field coefficients. Yeah. Also, for example, known divergence-free test fields.
That seems a bit...
Sorry?
Seems a bit strange, right?
At the first glance, it seems a bit strange, but nevertheless, if you go through the derivation, and you see it, you need not to assume. You have simply... You have to solve this equation with a test field here. And whether, for example, this is divergence free or not, has no influence on the BN, on the small BN.
Because you've assumed that div u is 0?
Sorry?
Because you've assumed that div of little u is 0.
The divergence of the velocity is 0, so that's important. That should work. Divergence of the velocity field is 0.
No, it depends. We investigated cases where the divergence of the velocity is equal to 0. I think this method would also work with known with velocity fields which are compressible.
So,
even the papers I showed you here, there is a small the divergence of the velocity.
Yeah. Please.
By using this method, you are visualizing for entropy.
Can you speak more clearly?
Just could you repeat the question, please, before you answer?
So we can all hear.
I'm just wondering what he found by using this method on the eta quench.
Eta is quenched. It was investigated in the case of originally homogeneous isotropic turbulence, which is then under the influence of Belvami magnetic field. It deviates from homogeneity and from isotropy, and in this case both alpha and eta t are quenched, but eta t much less than alpha. So in a range, help me if necessary, magnetic Reynolds number between 2 and 600, the eta is quenched by a factor of about 3, and the alpha is quenched by a factor.
Ian has been waiting patiently.
Couple lines.
I mean, no.
Oh, sorry.
So
Are these effects you're calculating dependent on a k? Is it supposed to be a function of k, or are you just going to limit k goes to naught?
What is the function of k?
The coefficients. Are they functions
they
of
are,
k?
If you make this ansatz, this is R, first functions of k.
So those are.
But you shouldn't take them too serious for k unequal to zero. They are correct in the limit k to zero.
So I've got two questions here. One, what's the difference between this and what's been done in the past, where you just take a constant field and then you go to gradient of the field? So what's different from that?
The difference from,
well, the, normally you don't, the traditional way of getting an alpha effect, and Steve's already said this, you take a uniform field and you calculate the alpha effect.
Yeah.
Then you take, you worry about gradients of B and you get the beta effect. So what's different about this?
What is the gain?
What have you got that is different to what would have been? I mean, you've done all this stuff. I mean, what's the difference between what you've done now and what you've done traditionally?
Positionally, I know the results of second order approximation.
But shouldn't they give the same answer?
I mean,
don't they give the same answer?
I hope I understood you correctly.
No, I would say the following thing, that of course you have a simulation which has got, let's say, a periodic box, then you will not be able to put just a constant gradient. So if you want to go, constant field is okay.
Look, that is, if the concept of an alpha effect, and you've called it eta here, that equation for E, we think about alpha effect and beta effect, if that concept is firm theoretically, then the way to calculate it is, as Andrew indicates, take your first test field, uniform B, and calculate alpha.
Yeah.
Take your second test field, B with uniform gradient, and calculate beta.
Yeah.
Why do anything else? What is your test field?
That's not the only possible expansion of field.
Uniform gradient is not so easy. If you make calculations in a box, sets by, I mean, use this k-set dependence.
So is it an aid to numerical work when you're constrained to a box? Is this the point? Yeah. I mean, the value, I'm worried about if you're calculating an alpha here and an eta or a beta that turn out to be dependent on k.
Mm-hmm. So it should be valid only in the limit of k by kf, forcing the number to go to very small value. So there is an approximation, of course, that how small should it be, of course. So practically speaking, one has limitations, I guess.
Okay.
So I'm not there.
Let me suggest we get Fausto's question.
Oh, no, mine is back to this thing. I mean, if we go back one slide, right? Basically, you had an equation that was exact, it was the induction equation. Then you split the solution into mean and fluctuating part. Mm-hmm. So if you solve those two together, you should still get the same answer as before. Somehow, you don't solve the mean part, you fix it to be the test, you stick it back into the fluctuation one, but then you say you get the same little b, which is, okay, why can't we do it with all equations? Why can I just always get the mean wrong and still get the fluctuations right? I mean, that doesn't sound right. You're saying that the fluctuations are independent of what you're taking as the mean. For any linear equation, which seems, you know.
No, but you solve for the evolution.
No, they are not independent.
That's what I mean. The mean is not the correct one. The mean is not a solution.
But it is important to distinguish.
Also, no. Listen to the answer.
Yeah.
Well, I was answering that question.
It is important to distinguish between the mean field, which you have in your induction equation,
right,
and which influences, of course, the small b, and the test fields.
Right. You're doing it wrong. So your solution for little b is not a solution of the induction equation.
You mean?
Because your test field is not the average of the solution of the induction equation.
It's just not
arbitrary.
It's just not.
So your little b is not the fluctuating part of the solution of the induction equation.
No.
And yet you say that if I compute average over it, it works out fine. That's the bit I don't understand. You do everything right.
So, also, let him respond.
Then he made points as well.
You said, I need to finish my sentence, okay? So the sentence is, you do everything. I mean, of course, if your test field is very close to the average of B, then you're pretty damn close.
No necessity. Okay. Produces,
then it seems you can solve, you can solve the equation by getting half of it wrong.
Well, is there another measurable? Is there another measurable mean of the solution which is floating around in there somewhere?
No. It's the real mean of the induction equation, which evolves from the induction equation. But that's not the same as this test field, which is a fixed mean, which may or may not be the mean.
Right. So
it'd be a miracle if it were.
So there's a difference between those two means.
It doesn't matter at all.
Because the whole point is that the alpha, say you work, you focus on alpha, it should be independent of the mean theory.
The alpha
should, but the mean by which you compute it will not. I can think of millions of ways that are wrong. And we'll give you a number, but that is not what you want.
Let me use the chair's prerogative to ask a question, which I often ask of my colleagues, faced with similar situations, which is there a falsifiable hypothesis? How would you know if you were wrong?
For example, if you in this. Thing which we are all involved in recently is an alpha squared dynamo in a box and it saturates. And then you have calculated these alpha coefficients and the eta coefficients, and then you stick it back in and see whether you have a self consistent. The thing which he was talking about earlier by Schröder, where you calculated the coefficients and then you stick back in that mean field induction equation. And verify whether the actual field obeys those.
But the solution of the full equations does not exactly obey the mean field equation. So then there's a measure of how wrong you are, which is some B wrong over B correct, which is not zero, I suppose.
Not zero.
Any mean field solution will not be the complete solution of the direct simulation.
Several reasons for deviations. For example, the assumption that the electromotive force depends only on B and the first special derivatives. In fact, it depends also on higher.
I would hope on the time derivatives as well, of course. In the back row, please. I'm sorry.
have anybody tried to plug average magnetic field epsilon from the DNS, like from the real life, not from the model, and have this equation for alpha, have it converge in the case for real data.
At least in the case of this geodynamo model, it has been done. Mean field models have been constructed, and the solutions of these models are close to the solutions of the gained by the direct numerical simulations.
Okay, so Steve, please, and actually we'll need to move on probably to the next presentation soon.
As soon as k is non-zero, you have the chance that b bar will grow exponentially via a dynamo, the correct b bar. Is that right? The correct V bar, looking like sine Z could grow, or sine X could grow exponentially. Yeah. So then coming back to Dan's point, if you do correct V bar over your V bar, because one's growing exponentially and one's not, one is held fixed. So what happens when you have a dynamo that amplifies all scales in your box? That's what I don't.
Grow exponentially.
But your test field will not.
The test field is assumed.
Yeah, okay.
Will not. You can use the real solution E bar as one of the test fields.
Right. Oh, very good test field.
Let me suggest that we move on. And I guess, as I understand it, Alice's presentation fits into this presentation conceptually in some way. And so maybe it would make sense if it's okay. Okay, and we'll make sure to have plenty of time at the end. But so if you, shall we switch? Yeah. You want to go ahead and Allison?
Are we still the OHP?
Yes.
You need. Yeah. Oh, okay.
So everyone, so to thank you, Corporal. We'll switch to
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, engines work.
One of those.
Anybody remember?
Ooh, look at them!
How cute, how queen!
If the bulb, if the bulb is functional, the power supply is worth.
Can we have it in semaphore, please?
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so please have that. So you have just another five or so, I guess?
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
Okay, I decided to be very old-fashioned, so not a few slides, but then I'll use the ball to that.
You're very young to be old-fashioned.
Okay, so what I've been looking at so far is that trying to calculate the alpha effects in the Galloway-Proctor flow. So what does the Galloway-Proctor flow look like? It's a 2D flow. Well, I guess you all know.
There's a guy over there that doesn't. I mean, there's a guy sitting at the back. It's a guy. He hasn't got a clue.
He's
the one
that's used it the least.
Okay, so it's defined by a stream function psi, which only depends on x, y, and t, so two spatial coordinates. I'll just write it down.
It's an board light on, so
the problem is if you put the board light on, you can't see the board.
Many brackets, but okay. This is what the stream function looks like, and basically the flow looks like an array of helical cells. And with this time dependence, if you forget about the phis for a minute, all this array is just rotating with time, which gives you this kind of Yakunov exponents. So I don't know whether you can see, but what's the difference between these two plots is the value of this parameter epsilon here. So if epsilon is zero, you get a Roberts flow, where you have no time dependence, and it's an integrable flow. But if epsilon is order one, then you've got regions of Lagrangian chaos.
So the dark is our negative, it appears, and the lighter the color is, the more positive the exponent.
That's right. Yeah, well, these are basically zero.
Those without telescopic vision.
Right, so the first thing we did, it's not a turbulent flow, it's very remote from that, but that wasn't the point. It's a fast dynamo, so we wanted to see if we could say anything about the alpha effect in a fast dynamo. And this is what we get using the method of having an imposed uniform mean field. This is alpha versus Rm for different values of epsilon. So basically it's all over the place. You just got the low Rm bit where first order smoothing is valid. So it doesn't depend too much on the details of the flow. But as soon as you increase Rm, then it depends a lot on epsilon.
So just to be clear, what do you mean by alpha?
Alpha.
I just want to make sure that we're all we'd be arguing about the same thing and not about something tangential.
Okay, let's write the induction equation. The equation I'm solving is the induction equation with an imposed mean field. So it's like this. Okay, so that's basically the fluctuating field corresponding to this uniform imposed mean field. And in that case, the EMF, which I get by averaging over space and time, which is easy in that case because everything's periodic, so the average is well defined. And then this is just equal to alpha dot P0. Now this alpha here is, because the flow has some symmetry properties, this alpha tensor, we're just interested in the horizontal part of it, and it's written like this. And we're just interested in the symmetric part, which kind of corresponds to the alpha effect. Right, so this is what we got at that stage. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep epsilon is 0.75. I'm going to look at this case, and I'll introduce temporal decorrelations in the flow. So that's where the phi here comes into account. What we've done was introducing a phi which depends on time, with a characteristic time scale which we call tau c, like a correlation time, and we had to look at how it influences the alpha effect.
Alex, maybe you should say that little b is assumed to be z independent, so there's no...
That's right. So little b is, you know, n. It just depends on x, y, and t. So there's no z dependence, there's no small-scale dynamo, and that ensures that the EMF is linearly and homogeneously related to the mean field, so we don't have any problems.
So this b is in the xy plane?
That's right, yeah. Okay. Well, can you see anything?
Thanks,
Steve. Okay, so these are time series of the EMF for different values of like the correlation time. This is for very short correlation time, so I make this phi vary very rapidly, and it looks like it's kind of random. And if it's a bit longer, then you see it kind of tries to get back to the periodic solution, but then it gets messed up as we change the phases. So in that case, this is what you get for the, again, the same alpha. The only problem here is because you're changing the time, it's not periodic in time anymore, so you need to average over quite long periods. And the dark line is the normal Galois-Proctor flow if phi is equal to zero. And if you reduce the correlation time, then you get that alpha seems to tend to an RM-independent limit. And the stage at which it reaches this limit depends on how short the correlation time is. Right. But you should all know this because it was on the paper on the web. So the new stuff.
Now comes the quiz.
Okay, so what we've done so far is have a look at the Galois-Proctor flow and put some time dependence here. But what we've been doing lately is instead of having a phase that depends on t, we've put a phase that will depend on x and y. So instead of introducing temporal decorrelations, we've introduced spatial decorrelations. And in that case, the flow is periodic in time. Okay, so what do we get if we do that?
Oh, can I just ask a question? Yeah. In the previous case, is it still a fast dynamo?
It is still a fast dynamo, yeah. Yeah. Right, so that's what the flow is going to look like. This is the normal Galois-Proctor flow, but just kind of blown up.
These are streamlines we're looking at?
These are streamlines, yeah. Yes. So that's the streamlines of the normal Galois-Proctor flow. And these are the streamlines when I've kind of changed these phases. And this is what the X component of the magnetic field looks like. So that's the usual eigenfunction for the Galois-Proctor flow. And you see that when we've randomized it in time, in space, we've got more constellation occurring and everything is closer to zero. Yes.
How does the growth rate change? How does the chaotic property change?
Okay, the growth rate doesn't change that much. At least, okay, if you want to have a look at the growth rate of the Galois-Proctor flow, you need to have a mean field that, sorry, not a mean field, but a field that depends on Z. So you put, oh sorry, instead of putting the z here, you look at solutions that look like e to the I kz with a wave number k. And I've just had a look for k is, you know, from 0 to 1 basically, and it doesn't change much. So that is still a fast dynamo. And sorry, the Lagrangian properties, if I go back to this thing, that's the one I'm looking at, because I'm looking at epsilon is 0.75. Basically what happens is it's a bit more messy, but you still have some regular islands in the flow. This is nice. Right. Well, we can have a look at what we get for. Oh, maybe I should explain a bit more. So basically, the way we are changing these phases is that our computational box. This is still 2 pi by 2 pi, but then the flow is defined on that scale, which is 2 pi over k. So you can imagine that we've got like many different Galois Proctor flows with different phases here. So if I have, you can have pi 1 1, pi 1 2, pi 1 3, etc.
So and how do you pick these phases? Just randomly?
Well, that's I'm coming to that. You can choose them differently. So you can choose the simplest case, 0, and you get back to the normal Galois Proctor flow, albeit at you need to do some rescalings to get the same results. Then you can choose, at the other extreme, you can choose it from a random distribution between 0 and 2 pi. But to bridge the gap, what we did was taking a normal distribution centered on 0 and with the variance lambda that we increased. So you can kind of control the...
But they're still on these cells, or...
Sorry?
They're still... Every cell has one particular...
That's right. Every cell has a phi, which is taken from one of these distribution.
Mm-hmm. That means psi is discontinuous from one cell to the next. What does that mean?
No, because that's not really the way it should be written.
So phi is smoothly varying in space.
Basically, I add loads of flows of that type with different phis, and then I put some sort of masking function over it. Mm-hmm. So if I look at this cell, for example, my masking function will kind of go, you know, impinge on the other cells. It's maximum here, it's 0, and you have a tangent profile in between the two. Mm-hmm. So no, it's everything's continuous. Okay, and the only thing we do when we do that is when we have different phases in the x and y direction, we kind of break the symmetry, the xy symmetry of the flow. So we don't really have that anymore. And to prove this, which one? Okay, what's the next one? Right, so that's what we get for alpha 1 1 and alpha 2 2, which are the two diagonal components, and this time they are distinct. When I increase the variance of the special distribution, so when I go that way, it's more and more random, and it's for Rm is, I think Rm is 128 in that case, and the number of cells here is 16 by 16 in that case. So we see that alpha is kind of dramatically affected by the disappearance of the spatial order, and alpha 1 1 here seems to, well, this is 0 is here, so alpha 1 1 goes close to 0, and alpha 2 2 kind of changes sign. The other thing we have calculated with the same setup is the turbulent diffusion. Not beta, but the turbulent diffusion of a passive scalar. And this is what we get. So again, because the flow isn't symmetric anymore, the turbulent diffusion will depend on the direction. And this is what we get for the turbulent diffusion in one direction and on the other one. So it's
to resolve a passive scalar equation?
Well, I'll yes, but it's there's a passive scalar equation which is hidden into this one.
The
D equation for the magnetic potential, because you write B. Okay, B is equal to, because it's 2B, you can write it like the, you know, like the velocity field. So you have a vector potential for the horizontal component of the field, and then you have the OBZ. Yes, in the Z direction. So if you put that back into this equation, then you get the equation for A, which is the same as that for a passive scalar. So that's how we got this. Right, and what I can show you next is...
What was the x-axis?
The x-axis, that was the variance of... That's the variance of the normal distribution of the phases. So if I increase the variance, then the cells are more... Yeah, that's right.
Did you look at how magnetic energy will change with the longer?
Yes, I did, but I can't remember what it does, to be honest. But I can have a look and then come back to you. I don't think it changes much. Well, it does change because, the horizontal magnetic energy will change because that's how I calculate these things. So it changes a little bit, but not too much, as far as I remember. But I'll check. Okay, so that's what we get for alpha 1-1. So it's just the first component versus Rm for different values of the distribution. So again, the solid one is the normal Galloway fractal flow with phi is equal to zero. And then as it gets more and more random, then it seems that kind of alpha goes, well, is reduced in magnitude, definitely. So it looks like it might go towards zero, but then the other one was changing sign, alpha 2-2 was changing sign, so I'd rather not say anything here. You might see that you've got dashed lines and dotted lines. The dashed lines I've used 4x4 cells, and the dotted lines I've used 16x16 cells. Because obviously it's gonna depend on, you know, what exact values you pick for your phases. And this is what we get for the corresponding turbulent diffusion. So again, that's the value for the Galloway-Proctor flow, and then it decreases when you randomize the distribution.
And the decrease somehow reminds me of the similar behavior when you make the correlation time of the flow very short. So in that case, you have like a transport proportional to the correlation time of the flow, and similarly the kinetic energy also decreases. So I'm just wondering whether you need to normalize that by the kinetic energy.
Yeah, but I don't know what the, I mean, this flow is periodic in time, so the Eulerian correlation time will be infinite.
But now you're decorrelated in space.
That's right. So
there should be something given.
No, yeah, I see what you mean, but I'm not quite sure how to calculate that. Is it different?
Well, the Lagrangian particle would see a decorrelation in time.
That's, yeah, well, it would be a Lagrangian correlation time.
I mean, that's what she's working out, what the effects of the spatial decorrelations are. Transport coefficients.
I guess we should move into discussion soon if we're going to leave ample time for that.
We can discuss.
If you have one last.
I could show one last slide. Because, okay, that method with using the vector potential, that's not the first thing we thought about. At first I thought, I'm going to put a large scale mode. I'm going to put, for example, cos x into that and see how it decays. So that's the first thing I did. And then I did that one, and I couldn't match the two. And
the reason you can't match the two is that you need to go to very, okay, you need to go to very large-scale separation if you want for the two to match. So what I mean by that is I've used different ways of calculating the, don't forget about what's written here. This is just the turbulent diffusion measured by different methods. This method here, the triangle, is just using the imposed mean field and using the equation for the scalar potential.
To get a diffusion, don't you need a field with a gradient?
Okay, so that's how I get that point here. And these points were when I tried to put a large scale mode into these things. So to have a scale separation, I needed to have more and more cells. And sorry, it's not very clear what I'm saying, but okay, so I used the decay rate of the largest scale mode in my box, which gave me these three diamonds here. And well, obviously I couldn't go that as a such a large scale, because I didn't have enough resolution. So when it's periodic, you can cheat, and you can use a Floquet solution to solve your scalar equation, and you can kind of, you know, have an arbitrarily small k in here. So using that, I could match the two. But to do that, I needed to go to, you know, value of k, which was of the order of 1 over Rm. Does that make sense? So it just to say that it's not obvious. I mean, if you input a field, like for example with the test field, if you have a field with a certain k, you know, how small does k need to be in order to, you know, get something like alpha or get something like the turbulent diffusion? And in this type of periodic flows, it seems that it depends on Rm. I don't know what it's like for like real turbulence or more random things. Right, I'm not going to say anything anymore.
Questions, comments?
If it depends on Rm, then you could check that by changing Rm.
Yeah, it does depend on Rm, but I haven't worked out a scheme.
Why isn't the translation to an effective correlation time simply something like the correlation length divided by the Lagrangian velocity?
I take that as a suggestion rather than a question.
Right. But I mean, in that sense, it should be a straightforward connection, right?
It has the right units. Give it that. Please.
Yeah. In your 2006 physical review letter paper, you considered this case, also this all phi is equal to zero, and you had no omega at this place.
Well, we just took omega equals one. We didn't.
Okay. But you have to, you discussed the results that depended on the magnetic Reynolds number and epsilon.
Yeah.
But you have also dimensionless for omega, which is connected with omega. Either you write omega tilde equal turn over time to period, that means omega divided by velocity. Or you can write omega q, which is omega divided by eta k square. It is the magnetic decay time divided by the period. And if you follow this up, you find that in fact all your calculations are done with omega tilde equal to this value. So that means you consider only a subspace of the parameter space. And this is insofar interesting. We made some calculations with B means natural quantum, and I will show you one result. This is the parameter omega tilde. So say 0.110, the range around unity,
and then
you find for alpha there also smooth reasonable behavior here and here alpha, and there also strange behavior with negative values of alpha, and so you make your calculations just here. It's a space. Square root of 3.5. And similar is for gamma. You have here a negative gamma, or positive, I don't know exactly, maybe positive, here negative, rather smooth, and also crazy behavior inside. So I wonder whether you are, rather crazy results, it means crazy dependence on epsilon and so, depend on the fact that you are just in this region and not here and not here. Okay, you cannot answer this immediately, but I want to point out this fact.
No, but I mean, the crazy behavior is down to the flow. I mean, we were just looking at it's down to the velocity field we consider and the parameter range we consider. But I'm wondering, I mean, I know some people had a look at varying the frequency and what things look like. But if you get the frequency small or the frequency big, that might change the chaotic region and the way they are. And so it would be worth having a look investigating that.
Steve, just to comment on this, this is a crazy flow, you're right. I mean, you can blame that guy over there. It's a crazy flow.
Or Proctor.
Yeah, blame Mike Proctor. But, I mean, Alice has done lots of work on Atani's MW plus flow as well, you know, which is not such a crazy flow, decorrelating things like this. And a lot of what she said goes through, even without this, I mean, not so much the alpha changing sign and things like that. That really is crazy. But this thing of if you decorrelate the flow in space, then you suppress alpha significantly, but not turbulent diffusion, that kind of thing. It seems to be fairly insensitive to flow. But you're right, this is a crazy flow.
But, I mean, the point that the paper was to say that it's a crazy flow, but it has it's very helical, it's maximally helical. And there's a lot of arguments about what that means. Given the helicity of a flow, what can you say about alpha? And for small rm, you can say something very rigorous for the first order smoothing. And that there's a kind of hope that what you say at first order smoothing might carry on for larger rm. And it's clear that, you know, the flow is the same, the helicity is the same. And yet alpha changes sign. There's a value of rm where there's no alpha. It's still as helical as anything. And then it changes sign. So the point was that you have to be wary of relating alpha and the sign of alpha even to knowledge of the helicity of the flow.
So
same with the decorrelated ones in space. That is still a very helical flow. Each one is helical. Each one is rising and twisting. They're just not doing it. When they're not doing it in concert, then the average is killed dramatically.
Now, we actually probably need to move on so that the last speaker has ample time for discussion. But since I asked Dr. Radler the question, I will also ask you, is there a falsifiable hypothesis? How would you know if you were wrong?
I didn't really make any hypothesis.
I noticed that, actually.
So what's the question?
Is that something you can be wrong about?
But I'd like to argue with you that there is a time scale in the problem, right? And then omega introduces a second time scale.
Sure.
So the ratio of those two guys is a hidden, if you wish, hypothesis. You're perfectly allowed to do it. You just have to realize that you are doing that hypothesis. So there the question becomes, when you change that ratio, what happens?
Sure.
So we probably need to, is the hypothesis something to do with
the behavior with the Kubo number, which you, or Struhl number, depending on which country you're in? And basically, you now have two levers on it, both the time and the scale, and you can examine its passage in different regimes and different directions.
Yeah, I guess in the end, the forming hypothesis often means there's a prediction in the end that can be tested, I guess.
You could say that was falsifying an hypothesis that had been made by someone else. That was the thing to show that an hypothesis that had been made was wrong. That was the statement.
Okay, so you probably, yeah.
So what was the hypothesis?
That alpha looks like the helicity. And clearly it doesn't.
There's no reason to believe that it should when the magnetic Reynolds number is not small.
I agree with you, and that's why we did this.
Because
you can say, there's no reason, but because it's not sort of kind of
astrophysical. It's up and down.
Yeah.
Okay, so for our last presentation then.
And now in English. Not in machine language.
Yeah, so we get three entirely different accents for the three different presentations. That's great.
Steve.
No.
What did you do?
You have 11 seconds before.
Please.
Can you talk to the light?
Yes.
Right, so we heard about the old crazy thing, so what I planning to do is the possibility of predicting anything, especially theoretically. So is there a theory that may work? And this may be provocative statement, given the fact that turbulence is very complicated phenomena, so you cannot do much with your pencils and paper. But I thought I would start with a big statement so that you do not lose your interest. So what do I want to talk about? The thing that I would like to present is the effect of a shear flow in shear turbulence. I'm going to discuss more later, but let me just thank my various collaborators from the past, especially my two students, Andy and Jamie, and postdoc Nicola Leclerbost, and I also acknowledge my long-term collaborator Berengera and Pat Diamond, and even Fausto Catania. Fausto, are you listening?
Yes, Fausto.
Yes. And I'll tell you why.
Were your contributions positive or negative?
It's very positive.
You should be eliciting.
On average, there was zero, right?
I mean, it's very positive. He got me started working on this dynamo long ago. So what am I talking about shear flow? So the shear flow can do various things for you. First of all, it's a source of turbulence, so you just make things very complicated and you don't know what to do with it. And secondly, it can also generate large scale fields. So if you shear the colloidal magnetic field, you can generate colloidal magnetic field. The last point that I would like to focus on this talk is the effect of a stable shear flow, which can make a very weak turbulence. From now on, I'm going to forget about the first two possibilities and just to focus on what the third one will do for you. So here is the cartoon pictures what a stable shear flow can do. You have your cup of tea or coffee in front of you, and you try to stir it with your spoon, and what you do with doing it is just make little edits, which can just transport the coffee and the sugar or whatever. So imagine this little circle is those eddies. And imagine now putting linear shear flow, stable shear flow, in one direction.
Shock, did you say? What flow?
The shear flow.
Shear flow, yes, sorry.
Thank you for asking, yes. The shear flow will drag these eddies along. So, for instance, if you look at the top, it will drag more than the bottom. So, as time goes on, this round thing will get distorted and will tilt it, and it will reach very fine scale such that the molecular dissipation becomes very effective by the time you need another break over eddies. So what you do is kind of enhancing the forward cascade from large scale to small scale. So you generate the small scale very efficiently, and when you do it, you have the molecular dissipation coming in to dissipate the structures. So the result is that the overall the energy contained in these eddies becomes very small. And the other consequence is that the transport is also reduced.
But this large turbulent eddy could be thought of just as the shear flow itself.
That is correct.
It's a large scale vorticity field.
In that case, you have this second scenario. In that case, you will have like a direct interaction. If you imagine your eddy as a large scale, then these large scale eddies will be distorted by the shock when there is some other consequence. But I'm going to ignore that possibility here. Okay. I'm going to envision my eddies just kind of small, and I string the turbulent transfer. Right, so as Pat knows very well, this is very important mechanism in fusion in controlling the transport. You have hot cooking up when the hot plasma in the center, which wants to move out where it is very cold. Let me just give you the feeling for what is happening here. We have like the center of the temperature hotter than if you have a Tokamak, the temperature at the center is like 10 million degrees. And at lower, you have like few hundred K. You have a very strong temperature gradient. So it's not easy job to get the fusion going because, you have the device over like 1 meter or 2 meter cross-section. So it's very turbulent. You will have a lot of instability. However, you can have the generation of shear flow, which is called zonal flow, which can kind of help you confine the plasmas in the center. And so this is important mechanism, not only in fusion, but also controlling mixing the atmosphere of the ocean as well. So let me just comment on the contrast.
The problem is very strong shear, right? With the shear times the turnover time should be much larger than one.
Yes, for this reduction factor, you need to have the shearing rate rather than the inverse of the decorrelation time or your turbulence. So let me just contrast this effect to what waves do. This is what I learned from Francisco Cattaneo more than 10 years ago. The waves not necessarily change the turbulence amplitude. Francisco, do you agree? He doesn't listen.
I'm listening.
Is that correct?
You keep emphasizing this long time ago aspect of this thing.
Many centuries ago, Fausto himself.
If you have
a wave,
you will reduce transport, but not necessarily the amplitude. So you may have very vigorous turbulence, however, the transport will be reduced. And why does that happen? So simple example, you imagine transporting some magnet vector potential by velocity v, and you can express this as RMS amplitude of A and the RMS velocity with some phase factor, which knows about the phase difference between A and B. So if cosine theta to be zero, you have no transport, even if you have a very large RMS value for A and B. So when you have a shear flow, all of those can be reduced. However, if you have waves, it's more like the phase that gets changing. I mean, the amplitude can also change it.
So that is the difference between the quenching or transport when there is the shear flow. And what I like to do, I need to say about the alpha effect, but before I go on there, I would like to just show you what happens in 2D MH turbulence, where I can compare with the numerical simulation that my student is doing. So just imagine 2D domain where we have x in the direction along which the shear flow varies, and then the shear flow is in y direction, and you put the magnetic field parallel to the shear flow, so that there is no direct interaction between shear flow and magnetic field. If you had to put the magnetic field like so, then the shear flow will just distort this magnetic field to generate the other component. So I'm going to ignore this possibility. And there has been some theoretical prediction for what happens in this case using linear shear flow and uniform magnetic field with the Barringer long ago. And you can look at two limits. One is the weak magnetic field, where the shear flow dominates, and the other limit is strong magnetic field limit, where the shearing rate is smaller than the alpha frequency. So you can take this as kinematic region where you have a kind of low back reaction from the magnetic field. In the case you have the transport of momentum represented by the turbulent viscosity, so it's negative. So that means in pure 2D hydro, you have a kind of inverse cascade. And you have the diffusion of magnetic field is reduced inversely proportional to A squared. Here A is the shearing rate of your shear flow. So if you make your shear flow very stiff with a large gradient, then you will have a quenching in magnetic dissipation by shear flow. Now you can look at the other limit where you have strong magnetic field such that the alpha frequency is larger than the shearing rate. In that case, you know the turbulent viscosity is positive, or is quenched by the magnetic field due to the ionization. And you have now the diffusion of magnetic field quenched by both magnetic field and the shear flow.
But shouldn't there be actually four cases instead of two at least? Mm-hmm. Because you have, let's say, weak magnetic field as, let's say, small Lundquist mm-hmm. number and then large Lundquist number. But don't you have to separately treat low magnetic Reynolds number and high magnetic Reynolds number
there's
actually four different cases.
Yeah, I mean, this one is kind of assuming it is assuming the high Reynolds number and high
magnetic Reynolds number too.
Yeah, that is true. And why can we do this? Because if you have a strong shear flow, effectively your turbulence becomes very weak. So the nonlinearity becomes less important compared to the case where you have a low shear flow.
We can talk about that in discussion. So, see, well, it's a follow-up clarifying question.
How weak does B0 have to be at high RM for things to look like an anti-diffusion? How weak?
I mean, this guy.
No. You have weak B0.
This one.
Negative.
I mean, the transition from this behavior to the other just depends on the strength of the shearing rate and the alpha frequency.
And not the magnetic Reynolds.
No, this doesn't. I mean, both of them are assuming that your magnetic Reynolds number is.
So if it's sufficiently strong magnetic Reynolds number, it doesn't.
So probably within 1 or 2 minutes, we need to finish the talk so we can have a discussion to end with.
Yes, please.
I mean, this particular is very going to infinity. I mean, doesn't even make sense very going to more.
What goes to infinity?
There's formulas.
A
going to infinity? Is that what it means?
What is A?
Oh,
yeah, this is for large shearing rate. Yeah. Yeah, this is the initial limit, such that the shearing rate is larger than the correlation rate of the flow and also the alpha frequency. So this is kind of singular limit.
So you have another one or two slides, I guess, to finish? Or?
Right, so okay. Let me just show you the numerical experiment which confirmed the field prediction. So you are looking at the magnetic diffusion as a function of A, it's now called omega, which is the shearing rate, and different lines are for different strengths of the magnetic field. So the top line is for the weakest magnetic field. You can assume that the wave direction is ignored there, and as you go down, it is for the strong magnetic field. So for given strength of the magnetic field, as you increase the shearing rate, the effective diffusion rate of magnetic field decreases. And we have some... here is a little more complicated. However, this is completely kinematic region, and in here it is independent, and here goes like omega to minus 2. So that agrees with the prediction. And if you make your force finite correlated, you have an additional factor over A. Right, so I need to just show you the results for the alpha effect. So something similar happens to the alpha effect. And here is the configuration, it's a 3D. So we are also taking the magnetic field in parallel with the shear flow, and the magnetic field is uniform for the analytical computation of alpha. Here we only compute alpha. And the results are written here. I mean, so turbulent viscosity in T is now shown in the kind of kinematic region where the shearing is stronger than the shearing rate is larger than the alpha frequency. So you can just take this as kinematic alpha when the back reaction is very weak. So what the thing now, just look at the last bit, which is the new T going like the shearing rate to the minus 2 power, meaning that if you make your shear flow very strong, then you will have reduction in the momentum transport in T, and similar reduction appears in alpha effect alpha here, which goes like the shearing rate to the minus 5/3.
What's C?
I'm sorry?
What's C?
C is the kind of ratio of the shearing rate the shearing rate to the other one, viscosity. So it's kind of a ratio of the molecular dissipation to the shearing rate. And the other consequence of the shear flow is that in addition to quenching the transport, it also quenches turbulence level, as I mentioned earlier. And the quenching comes like the velocity goes like the shearing rate to the minus 1 power, and also it gives you some anisotropic turbulence. So there is some nice consequence of this anisotropic turbulence in the case of rotating turbulence where you can have the non-diffusive momentum transport. So bottom line is the alpha effect can be reduced by shear flow. And now you can look at the other limit where you have a strong magnetic field. In that case, you will have a quenching because of the magnetic field. And there has been some preliminary numerical confirmation of the alpha quenching by shear flow by the group at Queen's Mary, although the exact scaling remains to be seen. And this mechanism can be important for understanding the Tapocline resistance. And the last comment I would like to make is whether similar physics may be operating when you have like multi-scale turbulence. You may have like a shear flow appearing locally somewhere in your domain, and then may give you some pinching in alpha. That is, that remains to be seen. I know that the, if you make your flow more realistic, you have a wall pinching in alpha effect. And what else? Here is kind of advertisement. So we apply similar theory to various different systems. First of all, we look at how the momentum transport becomes reduced by shear flow, and also looking at how you have the anisotropic momentum transport, because the shear flow gives you some preferential direction. And we also look at the stratified magnetized shear turbulence, finding that because of the stratification, you can have inverse cascade again. And we look at the rotary wave, the beta plane turbulence, and the rotary turbulence. Thank you very much.
Please.
How do you drive the turbulence?
We put some forcing. You assume there is some external forcing driving.
And how does the so you imply a fixed force, and then how does the amplitude of the turbulence that's driven, how does that depend on the amount of shear?
Yeah, that is the so this is how we do. You assume that there is some external force that drives turbulence, and your turbulence amplitude comes out to be of this form. Here is the V0 square, which is what you expect if we do not have a shear flow.
So, but it's unnecessary in principle to add a force to drive the turbulence.
That is
because
right,
the shear itself
that's
can
right.
drive turbulence.
Yeah, that is right. But there's something that I'm looking at, how you do this more
conceptually. You're looking for the shear force
driving. This is a stable case. So it doesn't drive
it's energy stable?
Well, uniform shear, uniform flip, for example, is stable.
Linearly stable.
Linearly.
Energy stable key?
No, you're right. If you take a random disturbance, then it will amplify initially. You get transient instability.
Right.
But eventually it will damp out by viscosity.
And the lifetime of that is shorter than the age of the universe?
Depends. Well, depends on the relative number.
Do you have to be careful about that? If you've got a plane going between two planes, finite amplitude disturbances can persist in that, I believe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a physical shear flow, we tend to develop turbulence at modest Reynolds number and boundary layers, and then the boundary layers just drive the turbulent flow for all time.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Comments? Vast hunger probably among the participants who didn't bring lunch is probably so. Okay, well, I want to thank all the participants for kindly